The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
We're going on hiatus. I'm communicating with the fans via Twitter and explaining the technical issue.
That software is up. Functional. I'm trying to restart it again. I actually killed it just a few seconds ago. I'm not restarting it. All right, stand by, everybody. We're restarting the system. We just got the broadcast software back up. We're bringing up Skype to connect with Micah and get the show underway. Stand by.
Cobra 702, turn right, heading 025, runway 34 left, clear for takeoff.
Report field in sight.
Roger, Commander. Have a good flight. Take.
What? I don't know what I'm hearing over there, but oh my gosh.
All right, here we go. In 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
I'm going to have to edit that.
2, 1. You're live, baby.
Hey, Race. Alon Z.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Gralian bunker, I'm your host, Micah Hanks. This is the Gralian Report. Glad, as always, to be on the airwaves here on the ever-reliable KGRARadio.com hybrid radio, whatever that means. I guess we're going to find out shortly, as you're about to find out about what's happening in the world of, well, exopolitics. That's right, not a subject that we often address on this program, but one that we will certainly feature tonight as we go over news statements made by presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton as it relates to UFOs. But I just want to point out she's not the only one in the realm of politics who has addressed this subject seriously. We're going to take a trip down memory lane and look at all of those during hour two. First, of course, we'll have breaking news as it happens, coming to you live from the heart of the hollow earth here, where I remain and dwell as an underground dweller. Glad to have everybody here. Got the chat room even working. My gosh, everything's just working perfectly tonight. And that's what we always like about this program. Yes, indeed. So, we're also going to be catching up, I think, with a few emails, some heartfelt emails that came along to us via you, the fine folks out there in Gradioland, info@gralianreport.com. You can always send along your emails. Actually, I get so many emails at that address, I prefer that people, if you want to send along something for this program, shoot that over to me at info@micahhanks.com, or heck, even info@middletheory.com. Middle Theory's back up and running, too. If you haven't listened to that podcast yet, it is on iTunes, and you can get those guys right over there at middletheory.com, as well as the new daily news roundup. But speaking of what's going on in the news, before we get to that, I should say, actually, Hobbo the Hybrid is with us. How are you, Hobbs?
Oh, I'm much better now.
Yeah? Doing good? Yeah?
Yeah, just made a run from the ice cream truck back to the studio.
You're kidding, aren't you?
Can you believe they're already running ice cream trucks around here now?
Oh, and here I just thought it was the satanic, you know, clowns twinkling outside the window there, you know. Hey, I hope you had a happy Easter, Race.
I did, my blessed brother. I sure did. It was a wonderful weekend. you know, the old evil weathermen were calling for some rain on Easter. It never came.
No. Well, I got a little here. We had dark clouds, dark skies. And, of course, I went downtown after, you know, I did, I'll tell you, this is the truth. Especially on Christmas and on Easter, I always get up and I will go through my morning prayer, you know, which I guess is kind of a modified version of the traditional kind of a morning prayer that one raised in the Anglican tradition might do.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, but, and of course, my dad being a minister, this is if I don't actually attend Mass, right? Of course, Pope Francis gave a Mass, which was all over the news because he specifically addressed terrorism in the world today. And sadly, unfortunately, I think that the... you know, the casualty count may be up to 70 now with a blast that occurred in Pakistan. Yeah, suicide bombers. And actually, this is just in, this breaking right now as it comes to the threat of terrorism. Ever real, ever present, unfortunately, in this world in which we live today. But minutes before, actually moments before we took the airwaves here, we have got reports right now. A man who had been brandishing a gun and walked into the underground portion of a U.S. Capitol Visitor Center on Monday was shot and wounded by police after he pointed the weapon at officers. The suspect and a female bystander who suffered wounds were taken to the hospital. Capitol Police Chief Matthew Vederosa had said at a news conference. No police officers were injured, Vederosa explained. He said it was unclear how many officers fired shots. A weapon was recovered on the scene and the suspect's vehicle was found on Capitol grounds. Vederosa said that the man was known to Capitol Police. Now, I guess we don't know much more than that right now. But he says, based on initial investigation, we believe this is an act of a single person who has frequented the Capitol grounds before. There is no reason to believe that this is anything more than a criminal act. And a U.S. Government official, as yet right now unnamed, has said that there was no evidence of any kind of connection to terrorism apart from this lone individual. Still scary stuff. You know, I've got a friend of a friend right there at the Capitol Visitors Center. Whom I've probably discussed on this program just a little in the past. But, yeah, these days it's always scary. That, of course, on the heels of what happened since our last broadcast. Of course, we had this this incident that occurred in Brussels. And what's really scary about that, we won't cover it all right now because most have heard about this, and we did a whole thing on Middle Theory about that the other day, by the way. But there was this story that came out within a couple of days of the actual Brussels attacks, and this is the one that's got a lot of people concerned. A security guard who worked at a Belgian nuclear plant was murdered and had his security pass stolen, and apparently this just 2 days after the Brussels terror attacks. And his name was Didier Prospero. He was shot several times in the bathroom of his home. Apparently, the unidentified killers shot him. I believe his dog, actually, had been found. A sheepdog named Buse had been found. Maybe it's actually Bose. I gotta remember what part of the world we're in. But apparently this fella had worked for the G4S security at a Belgian nuclear research center. Now, Belgian prosecutors have denied at present that the 45-year-old security worker's access pass had been stolen. Apparently the prosecutor's office in charge of the case formally denied any connection between the murder of Prospero, who was shot dead on Thursday at his home, and the planned terror attacks that occurred. And again, what many had been concerned about that might involve this nuclear plant. He was in charge of security for a nuclear research center, okay? And apparently Belgian police are refusing to link that murder, although further evidence has been forthcoming in the last few days, and many of you have probably heard about this on the news, further evidence suggesting an ISIS plan to hit a nuclear power station. According to the New York Times, several employees working in the Belgian nuclear industry have had their security clearances revoked, okay, over potential ISIS plots. We don't know how long that'll last. Following last November's terror attack in Paris, as reported by the Daily Mail, Belgian police recovered a surveillance footage of a senior nuclear official in the home of ISIS ringleader Mohamed Bakali, who was arrested and is currently facing terrorism charges. It is just as well. And it's now feared that the murder could be, even though it's not been officially described as such, that it could indeed be part of this ISIS plot. What they, of course, would presumably hope to try and do is attack this facility and release radioactive waste into the nearby atmosphere, which is going to be really, really concerning. God forbid that ever actually happens. I hope not. But speaking of things being irradiated into the atmosphere, you probably heard about this when a volcano in the Alaskan Aleutian Islands erupted yesterday afternoon. The Easter eruption, we'll call it, yeah? sending ashes reportedly 20,000 feet up into the air, so it very well may have been darker skies a little further into the northwest. Now, the U.S. Geological Survey reports that the Pavlov volcano, situated at about 600 miles southwest of Anchorage, Alaska, erupted at 4:18 p.m. The tremors were felt in the ground, and the volcanic ashes were spewed to very high altitudes, raising the USGS volcano and aviation alert to warning and red, respectively. The agency has reported that the previous eruption took place in 2013, and then the ashes were sent to an altitude of actually up to 27,000 feet. I don't know if they rose any higher today or if there were currents that might have influenced that yesterday. But according to the agency, the Pavlov volcano has a diameter of around 4.4 miles and is one of the most consistently active volcanoes in the Aleutian Arc. The volcano has had 40 known eruptions in recorded history and is considered very active in the Alaskan Aleutian Islands. Now, one of its most powerful eruptions apparently sent ash as high as 49,000 feet. But that active volcano is not close to any busy habitat region, so people aren't particularly concerned about this. Although I do want to point out that they say there's no significant danger due to the volcano's eruption, but the USGS is keeping a close eye on it. It has been reported that the eruption may affect aviation. They say that there's no report of any casualties due to the eruption, but get this. Now, there's this 2.5 magnitude earthquake that struck near Huntington Beach just as well. The LA Times reporting on this. They said it was a shallow magnitude 2.5 earthquake that was reported Sunday evening just within hours of this eruption. And that'd be, again, the epicenter being 3 miles from Huntington Beach, once again according to the USGS. They said that this trembler occurred at around 10:44 p.m. Pacific time at a depth of 8.7 miles. Now, according to the USGS, the epicenter was 4 miles from Seal Beach, 6 miles from Westminster, and 6 miles from Fountain Valley, and that in the last 10 days there had been one earthquake of magnitude 3.0 centered nearby. Could that have anything to do with this eruption? I don't know if there is any kind of a connection. But here's something else the USGS has been saying. They've said that there may be 7 million Americans at risk as a result of earthquakes, but not the kind that we're hearing about right now out west. No, the kind that are man-made. You know, earthquakes, of course, are a natural hazard. But the oil and gas industry, as reported by the Washington Post, has aggressively adopted the technique, of course, known as hydraulic fracturing, or more commonly, fracking. And this is used to shatter subsurface shale rock and liberate the oil and gas lurking there. And the process results in tremendous amounts of chemical-laden wastewater. Now, horizontal drilling for oil can also produce massive amounts of natural unwanted salt water, and the industry disposes of that wastewater by pumping it into deep wells. That actually is what is the culprit here. That can cause literal movement of the earth. Now, on Monday, the USGS published for the first time an earthquake hazard map covering both natural and induced quakes. This map, which was released earlier today, the map and an accompanying report indicated that parts of the central United States now face a ground-shaking hazard equal to the famously unstable terrain of California. Yeah, so if you are unused to work to earthquakes, if you haven't lived out there, you know, along the San Andreas Fault, or if you haven't lived in any part of the country where you can expect earthquakes, that may change very soon. In fact, they say some 7 million people live in places vulnerable to these induced tremors. This according again to the USGS. The list of places at highest risk of man-made earthquakes includes Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, Arkansas, Colorado, New Mexico, Ohio, and Alabama. So Race Hobbs is right in the epicenter. Most of these are... Yeah, that's right. It's going to be one hell of a hobo time. And most of these earthquakes are relatively small in the range of magnitude 3, but some have been more powerful, including a magnitude 5.6 earthquake that was recorded in 2011 that occurred out in Oklahoma. Again, that was apparently linked to wastewater injection. Now, and again, you know, I've been following these for quite a while because when I started looking into the mystery boom reports, one of the things that people were asking about, they were saying, are any of these mystery booms as a result of fracking? Actually, unfortunately, people weren't asking that. They were saying, stating as though they knew that this was the case. You know, these mystery booms are, it's fracking or it's global warming, you know, and
Michael, we've been under hundreds of quakes in the last several years. A year, hundreds.
Have you felt them there at your house?
One we did that came out of Oklahoma, yeah.
Probably the one that I was mentioning there, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. It was in eastern Oklahoma. But most of them in Arkansas take place over on the eastern side of the state.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you may need to run over the old procedure for, again, most of these aren't going to be very significant, but you never know. You never know. There can be property damage and things like that that can ensue. But again, you know, coming back to the mystery booms race, a lot of people would, again, kind of make that assertion that, oh, there's nothing to see here. It's fracking. I hate when people do that. When people, without any kind of scientific backing, will try and offer what seems to them the most likely explanation as though it were a fact or a gospel truth and then say, nothing to see here, move on. What's interesting is, just, again, within the last few days, it's like we did the show Monday last week, and then all the news has happened since then. Here's also what's been happening. People were emailing me on Tuesday, within hours of last week's broadcast, asking if I knew anything about the mystery boom that had been reported right here in North Asheville. Yeah, our hometown news station here, WLOS, actually reported on this. They said multiple people reported hearing a loud boom early Wednesday morning in the northern area of Buncombe County. Now, News 13 received messages from people in the Woodfin area, Weaverville, Alexander, Lester, and Reynolds regions who said that they had all heard that. Reynolds, I will say, being probably closest of those to the Graylin bunker, although maybe not all that close. Closest, at least, in terms of proximity. It said all that they had said that they had received multiple calls as well, but no cause had been found at that time. However, an officer with the Weaverville Police Department said that because authorities could not find a cause, it suggests the sound was from some sort of seismic activity. So when people started asking me about that, I'd said, you know, in likelihood, knowing that area, there again was a shallow earthquake that had occurred there, I think about 8 years ago. And many people actually heard a loud boom associated with that. We're right on the Brevard Fault Zone here in Asheville. And so, again, my best guest, Tyler Pittman, of course, was sending all kinds of information about this and said that he thought maybe there was something going on. I said in likelihood it was seismic activity. But then there was this update that came out on the 24th where I found out, yeah, not only were area police, but the FBI had been called in right here in Asheville. The FBI is called in to investigate this boom. The reason being that there had been, apparently, a explosion that was reported at a Woodfin construction site, which, interestingly, my father, being the rector of a parish in the Woodfin township, that's where the Church of the Redeemer, where he is, is located. And so my dad had actually been by there and apparently knew the guy and had seen some of the damage there at this construction site. Rick McElrath, and he said that apparently he hadn't seen anything like this. He said it's kind of worrisome that people have the capability of doing something like this. What he was describing was shattered glass, bent metal. Apparently there were some portions of his equipment there on the site that had been, quote, peppered with what appeared to be bullet holes just as well. Police had thought that it had happened between Tuesday night and early Wednesday morning, which roughly coincided with the time of that mystery boom being heard by many people. But I got to tell you, if there were people in the Reynolds area and other parts of eastern Asheville that said that they heard this explosion, it's not to say that it couldn't have been heard, and I'll tell you why. But I will point out that that's not close enough, I think, to be really considered in proximity to the Woodfin or North Asheville area where more people were saying they heard this boom. But the thing about these mystery booms that you got to remember, and this was reported about Mother Lode, California last year, it actually turns out that some of these reports involve explosions that occur in one location, and people, you know, maybe as close as 10, 20 miles away won't hear anything, but people 75, 100 miles away will hear these booms like it happened next door, and hence why it seems indeed like there is a mystery boom that emanates from the sky. And hence a lot of people have actually equated UFOs or something like that or secret aircraft with these reports. But what actually happens is the sound can be carried over such a great distance and through refraction off of the upper atmosphere, it won't be heard even closer to the boom, but people much further away will still report hearing these and extremely loud. There is scientific data, in fact, about this kind of, I don't know if you'd call that anomalous propagation per se, but it is sort of similar to what Jeremy Stone and the Federation of American Scientists were reporting back in the 1970s with the Northeastern booms. And the Concorde jet flying out over the Atlantic was actually, again, those booms produced by those supersonic jets were being carried inland thanks to anomalous propagation at that time. Similar to that, some of these booms can actually be carried over great distances. And there was one incident that involved a battle during the Civil War in which the generals that were overlooking the valley where the battle was taking place, they couldn't hear any of the cannon fire that was occurring down there on the battlefield, but at the courthouse in that county, nearly 100 miles away, they said that it sounded like the building was going to fall down from the shaking and the booming of that battle, and it was the sound actually being carried over a great distance like that. Pretty interesting stuff. So the latest mystery boom report actually comes from right here in my own hometown. We've got to hit a break real quick, but when we come back, we're going to be getting into a few emails from the listeners. And then, as mentioned earlier, later in the program, we're also going to delve into some of this presidential politics as it relates to UFOs. Hillary Clinton has indeed, well, I'd say dropped a bit of a bombshell as it relates to UAP. We'll talk about that here a little later on the program. It is the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
From the dark heart of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report, and I remain Micah Hanks. Glad to be here with you, as always, as we keep you company from 6-ish to 8 p.m. East Coast time every Monday night here on the KGRA Radio Network. It's always funny. I was just saying to the people, yes, I'm in the chat room. This is great. It feels really good to be in the chat room. We're making the chat room great again. But I was saying we should hold an international Graylian hangout sometime. I mean, all the technology exists these days between Blab and Google Hangouts and, you know, live radio, Skype. I mean, you have everything that you need these days to be able to do something like this, although it would be great to kind of have a central location. I will admit, by the way, I'm going to be at a bit of a hangout along those lines down in Dallas, Fort Worth, the first weekend of April. So, yeah, I like to get down that way and catch up with my bruds, Cam and Kyle of Expanded Perspectives, and a few others just as well. But what's always funny is, you know, when I'm live on the air and I'm sitting here in the bunker doing the show, you know, people always laugh and they say, you could be sitting there in your pajamas, you know, you could literally just do your work in your bedclothes. That's never the case with me, though. You would laugh because even if I am here in the bunker doing a live show, I am still wearing a sport coat. I almost always wear a sport coat when I record my podcasts. And as evidenced if you watch any of the video shows that I do with Jim Harold. Although, of course, then again, in those instances, you know, that's kind of because there's a camera on. But even if there's not a camera, I'll tell you what the significance of the sport coat is. It helps you get into that state of mind. You know, that you dress for business and therefore you look the part and you feel the part just as well. And I always noticed that when I was in high school, if I would dress professionally when I'd go do one of these, like a strings concert or something, I was in the strings program, played violin. You know, it's kind of, or it's really, conversely, you could say if you're going to be a rock star and you get up on stage and you dress like a rock star, you know, you feel like a rock star when you're jumping around playing guitar or whatever. So, yeah, when I'm doing the radio thing, it's funny because I've found that that same psychology carries over. And, you know, I generally have two things if I'm going to be in the studio, a bottle of water and a sport coat. I'm sure that might sound pretentious to some people. I don't intend it that way, though. Again, it's just a psychological trick for keeping yourself on top of your game. So, anyway, and I did it back in my radio days, too. People always laugh. They're like, you know, Micah, radio, you're not on camera. You don't have to dress up if you're going to come in here and host a show. I'd come in on the weekends and, you know, host the Saturday night radio shows from time to time. And, yeah, I'd always show up all dressed up. They're like, why are you dressed up? Are you coming from an event or something? I'm like, no. It's always just to keep me in that mindset. We mean business when we do it here. Speaking of business, we'll get to the business of listener emails. Nikki had tweeted at me earlier and just asked a quick question. She said, which book would you recommend in order to casually research the Illuminati? And I'll tell you this, I had a recommendation But I decided to go on Amazon real quick to look and see what other books are available. And I've got to be honest with you. You got to really be careful when it comes to books about conspiracies these days. Because I think that there is legitimate information, but then there are books that are written about conspiracies for conspiracy theorists, which often, I would dare say, take some liberty with the facts. And so I'm always a little skeptical of those kind of books. And when Nikki tweeted that earlier, I didn't want to just find the first book that comes up on Amazon, especially something I hadn't read. And actually, the recommendation I would make is the book called The Secret History of the West by the philosopher and historian Nicholas Hager of English origins. He's quite an erudite fellow, by the way. If you ever look at videos of him online, there are a few interviews. And he actually has a very deeply spiritual side just as well, which I find I appreciate that and also find it adds to the profundity of his work. But I'd certainly recommend that. Although, something else that really comes to mind if you're interested in the idea of the Illuminati is Robert Anton Wilson's book series. He wrote an awful lot about this. And over the years, now you got to keep in mind the series of books that he had written. He had a co-author with those, which was one of the other editors at Playboy, which is, of course, what he was partially known for. He'd written a lot of very interesting things over the years, and of course, had these books like Prometheus Rising and different kinds of things. But when asked about the Illuminati and the way that he would, kind of work it into his fiction over the years, as well as some of his actual, less fictional work, he said that I would often put people on. As a matter of fact, actually, I'll just directly quote him here, because toward the end of his life, Metzger, I think, had been the one who had interviewed him. And he said, you've studied the Illuminati for years. Have you come to any conclusion about their aims? Now, many people these days would, say that there is still a Illuminati. The Illuminati really historically are recognized as being something that occurred. Again, this goes back many hundreds of years. Some try to infer that they're still operative and or that they actually control the music industry and Hollywood and all of this sort of stuff. But without going down that road, this is what Robert Anton Wilson had to say about that. He said, usually when people ask me that question, I give them some kind of a put-on, but I can't think of a good and original put-on that I haven't done several times before, so I'll tell you the truth for once. He says, after investigating the Illuminati and their critics for the last 30 years, I think the Illuminati was a short-lived society of free thinkers and democratic reformers that formed a secret society within Freemasonry, using Freemasonry as a cover so that they could plot to overthrow all the kings in Europe and the Pope. I'm very happy that they succeeded in overthrowing all the kings. I just wish that they had completed the job and gotten rid of the royal family in England, too. But they did pretty well on the continent. I'm sorry they haven't finished off the Pope yet, either, but I think that they're still working on the project, and I wish them luck. So, Nikki, there's you some information about the Illuminati and its historic origins from within Freemasonry. Jeff writes, hello, Micah. I've been a listener for about a year now and consider the Grailian Report the most professional and well-researched podcast on the paranormal subject. Well, thank you for that, although I would say it's actually just an Illuminati conspiracy. He continues, that is why I chose to share this real-life ghost story with you. This is a true story that my family experienced, and I hope it will be of interest to you and the Grailians. To begin, I have a science background, but have always been interested in subjects like UFOs and other sci-fi topics. However, I'm more of a skeptic than a believer. Well, we have that in common, don't we? He said, I do leave open the possibility that the paranormal could exist, but I would need solid proof to become a quote-unquote believer. I don't even like the term believer anymore, Jeff. I actually these days say advocate. And there are many reasons why I would say that, but we won't get into that right now. So he says, in 2000, I was a military officer, and we, my wife and two children, and I moved to Fort Riley for my first duty assignment as an officer. We were placed in a housing area called the Stone Court on the old area of the base. Fort Riley has a new housing surrounding the older main post, but much of the housing on the main post is in historic buildings. Our building happened to be a duplex constructed of 18-inch thick limestone blocks. It had two levels and a basement. At the end of this letter is an excerpt from the Fort Riley walking tour that details the dates of construction. He says, almost immediately after moving in, my wife began complaining about me leaving the basement door open all the time. Since we had small children, this was especially uneasy. Well, I'm scatterbrained at times, but I was very aware of the safety of our children, sometimes to the point of being unusually overcautious. And that said, I would never leave the basement without checking that the basement door was locked at least twice, if not three times. I explained this to my wife, but was still often accused, since it was happening a lot, One day, I was at work and my wife called me frantically stating that someone had opened the window overlooking the backyard, and at that same time, the window over the sink. Now, these windows were on opposite sides of the house, and I had just passed both when leaving the house that morning. The windows were old, heavy wood frames. They were painted prior to us moving in. That made them very difficult to open, even for me. Sometime later, my wife and I were upstairs putting the children to bed, and when we came back downstairs to relax, we found that the back door at the bottom of the staircase was slightly ajar. Since we hardly ever used that door, it was odd that it would even have the latch undone, let alone be standing open. Now, flash forward about 6 months, and I get another startling call from my wife. That morning, she decided to go on the walking tour, or the ghost tour, along with her sister, who is in town visiting. She explained that the tour was fantastic right up until they stopped in front of our house. The tour guide proceeded to tell of a ghost that had been reported by several of the prior residents. The host explained that the ghost never caused any real problems except leaving doors and windows open. Huh. My wife said she just about fell out when she heard this. And before this, we didn't have any idea the post was even haunted, let alone our own house. She purchased 2 books about ghosts of Fort Riley after the tour. We really didn't see the story in either book, but the tour guide did tell them not all the stories were in the books. And after this, we just got used to the fact that the door and window openings were part of the routine. However, it did seem to slow down the longer we were there. We never heard any noises, and things never fell off the shelves or flew across the room, so we considered ourselves somewhat lucky. I hope you enjoyed that story. Boy, I did. He said, it almost made a believer out of me, but I'm still on the fence about it. Like you often point out, there are many synchronicities that can often be interpreted as being paranormal. We'll have another email from another Jeff here in a moment on synchronicities. Thank you, Jeff number one. Johannes writes, hi, sorry for my English. It's been a while since I last wrote or spoke it, but I've been listening to your podcast for about half a year now and have been a Graylian X subscriber since November. In your podcast, you sometimes mention books that you think are interesting and relevant to you. I was wondering if you had any list of particularly great must-read books. If not, is it something that you might consider doing? Many thanks, and keep up the awesome work. And he actually sends regards in Swedish, which unfortunately, if I try to do that right now, I'm going to butcher it or I'm going to make people's ears bleed, so I don't want to do that. But thank you, Johannes, for writing. And again, for those, I do get that question an awful lot, so if you go to MicahHanks.com, right there in the toolbar at the top of the page, you'll actually see favorite books. And if you click that link, they aren't books by me, that's the bookstore link. You can find those too. But the favorite books is actually a reading list that I have compiled because so many people wanted to know what kind of books I read. Yeah. Dr. Falcon writes, okay, this is going to sound strange, but one way that my friends and I really get a kick out of your show, aside from the great content, is to make a drinking game out of it. So years ago, I watched an episode of Frasier where they they would sit around and watch the Antique Roadshow, and every time the word veneer came up, they would take a shot. Well, for years now, listening to the Graylian Report, we've done the same things. So we've changed the words a little over the years, initially starting out with the phrase, I digress. Go ahead and take a shot. I swear there were times we'd be hammered by the second hour. Then we'd move on to words like mythos, or construct, or component. Over the time, those words or phrases failed to bring about the desired results, but about a year ago, we latched onto a phrase you love to use, and it has lit us up every podcast we listen to. In case you're wondering, it's just as well. They're already getting drunk, see? Every time you say it, we all yell, boom, and take a drink. In the past, we would all drink at the same time, but now we assign an order to it, so each person drinks when it's their turn. Well, lately, even that has caused us to have to call for a cab, if you get my drift. Anyway, I just wanted to give you some insight as to what's going on out here in Radioland while you're doing your live show. Micah, you love saying just as well as much as we love the show. Keep up the good work, my friend, Dr. Falcon. And thank you, the good doctor. Although, I'll tell you this, you're not the only person who's ever told me that you played a drinking game when you listened to the Graylian Report. I hope that I'm not that redundant, though. Although I'm sure that, well, of course, you know, if it's helping people out there wind down on Monday evenings and get intoxicated, all I ask is don't drive. Make sure that you've got a DD or that you've got an Uber or something like that. But, yes, enjoy yourselves. I'm always happy to hear
from you. Just as well.
Just as well. Oh, now we need a mystery boom sound effect. So every time I say it, Race, you can point it out and you'll add the boom sound effect for him.
That would be great. We're going to do that.
I know. And I know we're a little late on the break, but, you know, we're playing with the floating breaks tonight, if you know what I mean. So that first one that happened before the show was extraordinarily long. So
Oh, no, we're good.
Yeah. Okay. So I got one from Jen here. She says, Mike, I've been meaning to write for a while now, but life kept getting in the way. I loved the podcast on spirituality. It came at a time when I was seriously questioning what I really believe in. I've always had certain things I've never questioned, and I knew they were true and real, but due to some things that have happened in my private life, and, of course, the horrific terrorist attacks we always hear about, she says, I started questioning everything I thought I knew. It reminds me of your friend's dog quote, and I've told this to a number of people over the years. If only we could all be more like dogs, you know, live in the moment. That was John O'Donohue, you know, the late writer and former Catholic priest from Irish origins, like my friend Claire. Actually, she only lives there. She's not from Ireland, but John O'Donohue was. Let's see here. I digress just as well. Mythos. Anyway. So more than present and more loving and kind toward one another instead of this hatred that is filling the world. It's a scary world out there, Jen says. I'm terrified it's only going to get worse. So do you think that there's hope for the future? She's asking me. Or do you think that things are just going to get worse? I'm sorry if that's a dark question, but that's where my mind's been lately. She asks a few other questions, but I'd like to just address that one really quickly. And yes, I think that when we look at what happens, you know, with terrorism, when we look at what's happening, you know, with there are other things too, which may not necessarily be violent, but they certainly are concerning. Like I think, for instance, the surveillance state in which we now coexist. You know, there are definitely things that can weigh us down, and there are certain days of the week, yes, where I, like you, Jen, I will wake up and I will say, you know, what is this really all about? Are we beyond the point of being able to repair ourselves, our communities, our world? And I'll tell you this, there is always a light at the end of the tunnel. And in that darkest hour, hope springs eternal. I do believe that. I was sitting there last night, in fact, and I was having my one and only Guinness before heading back home after Easter Sunday celebration. And as I was sitting there and I was going over some of the news as it pertains to this presidential election, I got to that point myself and I was thinking, I was so upset with the kinds of candidates that we have, the kind of shenanigans that are always being reported. You know, whether it's, you know, these idiot candidates attacking each other or attacking their wives, you know, or lying, or being accused of lying, or voter fraud, or any number of other things, yeah, it can get pretty disparaging at times. That's why people, when they ask me, they're like, which candidate do you support? I say, I haven't really picked one that I support yet. I'm still looking at the ones I'm wary of, which is almost all of them. There are a couple of brighter spots, but I just think it's too early in the game, really, to worry about that. So I just monitor the situation and plod along. But I got to that point last night where I was just thinking, you know, between the dismal state of American politics, between the kind of stuff that we're constantly hearing about the Islamic State and their continued attack on not just Europe, not just religion, but really all things that we stand for in solidarity together in the free world. And I'm thinking, you know, what is the answer? I kind of stopped and said, maybe I should just get involved in politics. I even tweeted it. And somebody, very graciously, they tweeted back, they said, you know, maybe I'm the first to say it, but Micah, you should run for president. Well, I wouldn't start there. I mean, I'd start in state and local government, probably do something like city council, you know, maybe Congress or something like that, you know, Congress or Senate. Very seriously. Again, I think the problem is when somebody has no background in politics and all of a sudden they think that they're going to turn into like this overnight. I don't know that they go into politics for celebrity, but I'm afraid that there are some people who maybe, if not for celebrity, do get into politics for some of the wrong reasons. You know, again, I think as a process of understanding, learning government, understanding government, working within government, trying to affect change that is meaningful. Yeah, there are times I've actually thought about it myself. I know George Norrie said the same thing. He said for years that he's thought about throwing in. I even asked him one time if he was going to run for president. He never has. I don't know how serious George is about that. Although I have asked him, you know, and he said every time he's been asked by me, he's always told me he's, you know, at least seriously entertained the idea. But I think he's probably like me in the sense that, well, to be able to give oneself to public service, you have to give up what you do right now. I really love this. I really love being able to interact with the listeners. I really love being able to talk to people to be able to share these experiences. Gosh, we've barely got time for it. I'm going to try and squeeze in one more email, and then we're going to have to get to the rest of them next week because I mentioned we would talk about Jeff Adamson's email. My good buddy Jeff, he comes down here. He's a Greylean listener of many years, and he's listened for a long time and has come to Asheville twice, and we've hung out Had a great time. Imagine my terror when I start seeing, get well soon, Jeff. All the best to you. We're praying for you, all over Facebook. And I'm thinking, what has happened? Well, here's what happened, as he writes. He says, as you're aware, I had a heart attack on January 24th, 2016, which literally killed me. I was brought, it was brought on by shoveling snow. I came in, sat down, and asked my son for two big aspirins, which I chewed, but the pain stayed. My wife, Sherry, called 911 and was told it would probably be 30 minutes. As she was speaking, the EMTs pulled up. Everyone with any medical training told me later that the 30 minutes would have meant certain death. So he notes a number of coincidences. Here's the first one. He says, the EMT company was from the other side of town and heading into my area for coverage due to the massive snow. The driver, Eric, was listening to the dispatch as he heard chest pains and deviated toward my location. Coincidence number two. They all came in, evaluated me, and said, this guy needs a hospital. They stood me up. I took two steps and died, they said. In the ambulance, they, Eric and Wendy, worked on me for 2 minutes. They zapped me, brought me back. I had no heart rate, no breathing, no nothing for two solid minutes in the ambulance. Gotta get chills as I'm reading this. So it was more like 3.5 to 4 minutes. My wife tells me she had to navigate for them as they had no idea where the hospital was, and we were driving over 100 miles per hour. I don't remember anything except snippets of helplessness until I woke up in ICU with a tube in my throat, two or three IVs in each arm, and a catheter in my bladder, and a thermometer in, well, you know where those go, right? I was told I had had a heart attack. Two arteries blocked 100%. I believe God cleared one, the other was stented. 2 days in ICU and 5 days in regular care. I learned later from my cardiologist that the doctor that performed the angioplasty and stent was the best in Maryland. A personal friend of my cardio doctor, whom he referred to as the leader of SEAL Team 6 when it comes to cardiac catheterization. He was at the hospital on a Sunday in a blizzard when I needed him. My cardio doc also said many times how lucky I was at the time, since the time to intervention was so slow. Now later I visited the EMTs. I went back and thanked them all, shaking their hands. I actually kissed the two that worked on me. It was a tearful thing. Many pictures were taken, and they gave me a t-shirt. Then one of the senior guys there pulled my wife aside and told her he never expected to see me alive. In his experience, no one comes back from something like this. But they worked on me and for me like I was, or worked on me and for me like I was their brother. I owed them my life. And the funny thing was, they said in all their years that anyone could remember, I was the very first to actually come back and thank them afterward. Now in the hospital, my EF, that's the ejection fraction, was 25%, that it was a measure of how much blood, of course, is actually leaving the heart. My cardio doc told me if I got my EF to 40, he would be really happy, as you can live with that, and I would still be a candidate for an internal pacer or defibrillator. I had to wear an external defibrillator for 6 weeks. He says, think of a sports bra with electrodes and a heavy battery pack slung over one shoulder. Fast forward to Monday, March 21st, after an echocardiogram on Saturday, the doctor calls with great and wonderful news. He's giddy on the phone, and he tells me my heart is healed and my EF is back up to 55% better than normal, and I'm looking to be back at work in 2 weeks. So, Brother Hanks, I lost track of the number of meaningful coincidences there. And that's my story. Feel free to repeat any of it that you wish. My wife and I hope to see you this year in the early fall. Very truly yours, Jeff Adamson, a true brother and friend of mine. Jeff, I'm so glad that everything worked out well, and thank you for sharing your story, because again, it's moments like that where you realize that the way that things fell together that day in your darkest hour, it all came together as, well, intended. Really does make you think sometimes there's more going on behind the scenes, and I'm not talking about cardiologists and EMS drivers, you know, I'm talking about great things afoot in this wonderful universe of ours. So glad you're okay, Jeff. On the other side of this break, we'll get to the presidential politics portion of the program. I am Micah Hanks, and it is the Graylian Report, sending dispatches of cosmic love and truth your way. Once again, here in a moment.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
is the Grainian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grainian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
So honored to be your host here every Monday night or worldwide around the web via the Listen On Demand function of the wonder we call podcasting. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grainian Report. Oh gosh, you guys know the drill by now, right? Grainian X, that's grainianreport.com/X. You can log in, sign up, or actually I guess it's you sign up, then you log in. Show some support for what we do and get a little something extra out of it along the way. I'm always sure to make things fun here. I've had people tell me before that listening to Grainian Report is kind of like being a member of a secret club or maybe a society in which we, of course, the members, the Grainians, are the only ones that really get what's going on. Kind of like Buckaroo Banzai. You remember that film? If not, you ought to check it out. It's quite funny. And yes, bow ties are cool. Yes, indeed. New blogs up over at maverickpodcasting.org. The official site for the book of a similar title, The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. And finally, news, breaking news, daily intelligence briefs. In addition to the daily news we've been doing for years now at grailianreport.com, you can head it over to middletheory.com. If you're more interested in, again, American news, politics, current affairs, world news, that kind of stuff, you'll be able to find there. Sign up via email and get those news links sent directly to your inbox every day. Yeah, I'm one of the hardest working guys in podcasting, but I like it. That's the beauty of being able to do this. And I'll tell you something funny really quickly, and then we're going to get into this big story this week. What specifically Hillary Clinton said about UFOs, which confirms, again, I think all the kind of rumors and the things that have been said. It's been known that she's been interested in this subject. But in Time Magazine, again, being someone who follows news and politics, in addition to the kind of stuff we talk about on this show, I subscribe to Time Magazine. And Joel Stein wrote a column a while back in which he was talking about how he did a podcast. And although he was, again, parodizing a lot of attitudes in America, it was really kind of funny. Because one of the things that he had said was, he had turned down offers to do a podcast because there hadn't been one that paid enough. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, offers to do podcasting? That's the whole thing, is that podcasting to me is like an answer to radio. You get a radio offer, or you do radio, you know, and you're usually paid to do radio. Well, of course, some people, you know, of course, you also pay to do radio. And it's incredible to me, the thought that somebody would wait around expecting someone to approach them with a podcasting gig for which they will be paid. And then, of course, he laments the fact that his wife got onto him. Oh, but look at this. Dan James just tweeted at me. He says, Grainian X, smoking jackets required. Yes, he's a member of the society, by the way. The world's most secret society. Anyway, so the idea about being paid to be a podcaster and everything, he lamented that his wife was upset because he was doing, again, five episodes. And that it paid less than even print journalism did. And I'm thinking, I think the problem really with podcasting for profit is waiting around expecting to be paid for it. You know, if you want to do anything, my attitude has always been, don't sit around waiting for somebody, you know, to offer you a deal, you know, and to expect that whatever you're going to do, somebody's going to be willing to shell out money for you and pay you to do it. You know, I had actually done podcasting for years for free. And when we did start Grainian X, the first thing I decided we would not do would be the old bait and switch. Yep, you get half the show for free, and if you want to hear the rest of the interview with such and such, you got to sign up for Grainian X. No, we do stuff. What are you laughing at now?
Bait and switch.
Well, think about it.
That should be another drink. That should be a double shot.
Yeah, it should, shouldn't it? No, I'm serious, though, because, I mean, I get a little tired of the podcasts all, you know, they get you close enough, and then they get you hooked. You take the bait, and then you have to go and download the rest of the show. I get it. That's an effective model, but, you know, after offering this show, an entire two-hour show for free for years, think what people would have done if I just said, okay, well, you know what, now you got to pay for all the good content. And people came to me that we got negative reviews before I ever put Grainian X up. Negative reviews on iTunes from people saying, oh, great, now you've got a subscriber club, so now we all have to, like, you know, pay for all the good content. Well, no, what happens is you pay and you actually get access to additional shows, completely standalone programs, And you get Graylian Enigmas. Now, I will say, those who do subscribe love that show. They love Graylian Enigmas. We are, 23, 24 episodes in now. One goes out every month. Everything from ghost stories to the Dyatlov Pass, famous UFO sightings. Yeah, it's pretty cool. People do love it. But, you know, again, the one thing I always said I would never do was take this show and make it anything other than what it is. It's still what it has always been, and it is completely free and available to you. But when you get Graylian X, what I always like to think of that as being is, you know, you're actually showing support for all the hard work that goes into this show. Most of it, a one-man operation with God love him.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that, Micah. It is. A lot of people don't understand the hard work that goes into it. They think it's just as easy as turning on the radio and listening to somebody.
Yeah.
It's not. It's hard work.
Well, that's why I'm thanking you, by the way, though. Yeah, you interrupt me just as I was getting around to you, Hobbs.
Well, you know, there's no need to thank me, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I'm just glad you said that.
I'm kidding.
It goes unsaid too much.
Well, you know what, though? Seriously, you do lend a lot. And this guy right here, Race Hobbs, as far as I'm concerned, he is my brother, just like Jeff out there, and so many more of you, like Dan right there, you know, and X-Lady and Claire and people in the chat room. I mean, there are many of you that I actually correspond with because I like doing that. I like to be in touch with people. I don't like this whole thing of I'm going to build a wall, and people who listen to the show, they can listen, but they're never going to have any interaction with me. I mean, I regularly interact with people via Twitter, via Facebook, and on this show, which is why we feature these emails. And more people tell me, they say, you know, your show is really great, but one thing we love is your narrative style, the way you tell stories, and the emails that you share with other people's stories. Like the other Jeff, that ghost story, that's just wild, man. That's almost a jaw dropper right there. And I'll tell you what else was almost a jaw dropper, again, was the latest presidential hopeful that appeared on Jimmy Kimmel, yeah, and who was talking about, yep, you got it, UFOs. But then again, I mean, everyone who goes on his show is asked about UFOs these days. Hillary Clinton just happened to be the most recent. Here's what she had to say.
We had your husband, President Clinton, on the show. He said, I asked him about UFOs in Area 51, and if he looked in, because if I was president, that's the first thing I do. I go right into those files and see what was going on.
Right.
And he said that he did do that.
Yes.
And that he didn't find anything.
Well, I'm gonna do it again.
Yeah, why not?
Right? And you know, there's a new name. It's unexplained aerial phenomenon.
Unexplained aerial phenomenon,
yep,
really?
Yep, UAP. That's the latest nomenclature.
I like the old one. I like UFO. I don't know why.
Well, I think we can use them interchangeably. But I would like us to go into those files and hopefully make as much of that public as possible. If there's nothing there, let's tell people there's nothing there.
What if there is something there?
Well, if there is something there, unless it's a, you know, threat to national security, I think we ought to share it with the public.
Well, what if everybody's all hopped up on medical marijuana and everybody gets paranoid? I would love
it. That's why I want more research.
If you share it with me, I'll decide what is the best course of action. I really have my ear to the ground.
Well, you know, I'm more than happy to do that.
You know, I have to say this. Now, I'm not particularly a fan of Hillary Clinton. I've said that before on the program. The reason why, and we did a segment on Middle Theory about this. I do feel that she, more than most politicians, although many are very guilty of this, she has changed her positions and flip-flopped and then tried to say that she never said things that, in fact, she did say. I don't think that she really has a good track record with supporting, again, equal rights for LGBT. You know what I'm talking about.
We all do.
Specifically with same-sex marriage, she has not always supported that. And yet she tried, or at least she didn't say that she did, more specifically that she didn't. But we won't go down that road. The point is I think that she's flip-flopped on so many positions. That is a problem for me. Now, do I want to like her? I mean, I see her sitting there talking to Jimmy Kimmel. I love the way that she talks. You know, I think she seems almost kind of like your, you know, like your aunt, you know, that you want to go hang out with and talk with. You'd enjoy, you know, a beer with her at a wedding or something like that. You know, she has that vibe. And I have to say, the way that she talked about UFOs right there was so non-crazy. And that she brought up the whole UAP angle, I mean, that is extremely exciting, especially if there is a very good chance that this person could be our next president. But that alone is not enough to make me want to vote for it. It is interesting, though, that she said that. What's even more interesting than her usage of language, again, was Jimmy Kimmel. Every person that comes on his show who is a president, who has been a president, or who might be a president, he asks them about the UFO thing. I mean, are his producers telling him to do this? Is he genuinely interested? He seems pretty interested, doesn't he? I mean, he brings it up all the time. Now, researcher Grant Cameron. And by the way, Kat, she says she's a newbie. UAP isn't new, and that's true. UAP's been around for a long time. One of the things that actually brought Richard Dolan and I together in terms of, you know, communicating more had been at the time that the We the People petitions were first instituted when Obama took office. Of course, Stephen Bassett and the Paradigm Research Group had put together one which had said, you know, calling for the release of UFO information, and it got the requisite 100,000 signatures. It did. And, of course, the official response from the White House had been that there, again, is no evidence of any information being withheld. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton at least seems to think that there may be more information than that statement seemed to indicate. But I think that maybe the problem is that the information being withheld was presumed to have had to do with extraterrestrials, as was worded in that initial We the People petition. Whereas the subsequent one, which was put together by Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel, utilized the acronym UAP, Unexplained Aerial Phenomenon, which Clinton discusses right there just as well. And that, when I noticed that, I retweeted that. I tried to get Rich on the show, and of course Rich is always really busy, although he's gracious enough to actually take time to talk with us as often as he can. And he, again, had worded that so well, and I'd said, my God, why couldn't this have been the first petition that went out? And of course, it didn't get the number of signatures needed. But it was so well worded because it was more ambiguous. And I think that what is important is that those who really understand UFO research understand that you can't go jumping to the conclusion that what we're dealing with is extraterrestrial without question. Rich and Bryce, when they put together that second petition, tried to word it more ambiguously in a way that would account for all different possible phenomena that might fall under the UAP-UFO blanket, so to speak. Hillary Clinton, I will say, by her usage of that term, at very least seems to acknowledge that there may be information more than is currently available to the public, and also that, again, we do need to take a slightly less generalized approach to this, maybe a little less generalized in the sense that, well, we presume from the outset that we're talking about E.T. here. So, again, while I have a real problem with a lot of the positions that she, again, has claimed to support over the years, which apparently she doesn't, you know, I don't like when politicians lie, but then again, I guess by the same token, you know, really that's what politicians are best known for, isn't it? Pretty sad, isn't it? The people that we pick to represent us, you know, in government, the people that we elect and we put our hope and our faith and our dreams behind are best known for being liars. Oh, but anyway, so I was at least impressed with her usage of the language, but I want to go down down memory lane here. I want to go all the way back as far as we can to the earliest underpinnings of UFO interest in government, and we're going to visit a number of instances where presidents, presidential hopefuls, and those no longer in office but who had served as commander-in-chief actually did say at least something about UFOs. Many of them have. I've spent a lot of time gathering as many audio clips and as much information that indicates this in the broader sense of things for you. And so we're going to start actually with one of the earliest references I can find, actually, although I consider this one kind of pre-ufological. There is the alleged Battle of Los Angeles. I featured an article at GrayleonReport.com some time ago about that. And I don't think that the Battle of Los Angeles was anything, you know, really remarkable. And I'll tell you why. There had been reports circulating on the web for years about a large butterfly-shaped aircraft that was spotted and that they were firing at this thing, that they were launching shells at this thing for an hour and a half and that it wouldn't come out of the sky. You know, there's the famous photograph which some enhancements allege to show a saucer kind of shaped object, but really I think that with the grain and the exposure, you know, settings of a nighttime photograph taken so many years ago, presumably a longish exposure of some sort, you know, I don't know that that's the best evidence of some object hovering up there in the sky. What we do know, and I know that people roll their eyes and they hate this, but we do know that there were actually balloons in the sky at that time. That is confirmed. That is a fact. There is also a suspected forgery, a document that was released years after the fact as part of one of the ongoing series of alleged releases involving the MJ-12 affair, which claimed that a couple of aircraft were actually shot down and that these so-called planes were not believed to be of earthly origin. But again, that document unfortunately appears to be suspect, like a lot of those which have been associated with MJ-12 over the years. I mean, and again, even Stanton Friedman and I having lunch together over in Riverside, California, he said, you know, of course some of those documents are fraudulent, but there's maybe some good information just as well. I don't know that that's necessarily representative of some of the good information, though. But I bring up the Battle of Los Angeles because, again, although, again, historians will say that this was war nerves, and less likely, even many UFO historians, and I'm one of them who would say this too, it is less likely a UFO incident. Although there are certain ones that came in the years after, and even around that time, you know, the Foo Fighters, that might be indicative of something strange. There are many over the years who have looked at that one for some reason and tried to say that there was more to it. I don't think that's the case. But nonetheless, it is considered, I guess, popularly today, a possible UFO incident, you know, whether you buy it or not. Now, FDR had actually officially responded to it. He was not pleased. He wanted to know who sounded the alarm. And so there were documents, and these are still in the National Archives today, that show his actual correspondence the day after it happened and his concern about the actual operation of the alarm systems for these possible air raids. But I didn't include that one for all the reasons previously stated. The first actual mention that I can find of a U.S. president actually talking about UFOs is probably this one, Harry Truman, where he says very little but nonetheless actually does mention by name flying saucers.
Oh yes, we discussed it at every conference that we've had with the military. There's always things like that going on. Flying saucers, and they've had other things, you know, if I'm not mistaken.
It's kind of funny. I mean, I wonder why there's, like, you know, a train in the background. You know, Barry Goldwater had been a presidential hopeful. Now, again, many people would also say, by the way, whoa, hold on, slow down, you're skipping over a bunch of people. We'll come to Barry Goldwater here really quickly because, again, he talks about his own personal experiences. He was not himself a president. Many would assert, of course, that Eisenhower had alleged interactions with ETs and all kinds of things like this, although a lot of that is, again, widely disputed. We'll come back to that in a moment. Here's a quick clip from Barry Goldwater, however, many years after the fact, discussing his personal interest in UFOs just as well.
But I think that at Wright-Patterson Field, if you could get into certain places, you'd find out what the Air Force and the government knows about UFOs. Reportedly, a spaceship landed. It was all hushed up, quieted, and nobody ever, I've never heard about much of it. I called Curtis LeMay and I said, General, I know we have a room at Wright-Patterson where you put all this secret stuff. Can I go in there? I've never heard him get mad, but he got madder than hell at me, cussed me out, said, don't ever ask me that question again.
Now, of course, the reason that we feature that audio is, as you can hear, Goldwater is referring to events that had transpired in this period in history chronologically in which we would, of course, be looking at. He mentions, of course, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, an alleged crash, and, of course, the remains possibly of not just the wreckage itself, but maybe the occupants, where they may have been kept. So Goldwater did, of course, have a very serious interest in UFOs. Where we start falling flat, unfortunately, is where we begin to try and find information about some of the other presidents that would follow, specifically Kennedy, and even more difficult to find information from, Richard Nixon. Now, that said, there is some very important information that I feel involves President Kennedy in the form of letters that Kennedy had sent to the head of the CIA and I think also the head of NASA at the time. And these, apparently, these memorandums were sent only 10 days before his assassination, which has led some UFO researchers over the years to try and assert that there's possibly a connection. There was one secret memo that was reported in 2011, around the time of its discovery, one of two letters written by JFK asking for information about the paranormal, purportedly, on November 12, 1963, released by the CIA for the first time at that time. Now, author William Lester had said that the CIA had released the documents to him under the Freedom of Information Act requests that he had filed while researching for a book that he was writing called A Celebration of Freedom, JFK and the New Frontier. Now, one of these, November 12, 1963, had been labeled top secret. It was a memorandum to the CIA director. It read as follows. This is Kennedy writing. As I had discussed with you previously, I have initiated, blank, it was a redaction, and have instructed James Webb to develop a program with the Soviet Union in joint space and lunar exploration. It would be very helpful if you would have the high-threat cases reviewed with the purpose of identification of bona fide as opposed to classified CIA and USAF sources. Now here's the real meat and potatoes right here. It is important that we make a clear distinction between the knowns and the unknowns in the event the Soviets try to mistake our extended cooperation as a cover for intelligence gathering of their defense and space programs. When this data has been sorted out, I would like you to arrange a program of data sharing with NASA where unknowns are a factor. This will help NASA mission directors in their defensive responsibilities. There's so much more that could be said about this, but I do want to point out as it relates to this. And there were other memorandums, too, that were a little bit more vague. That one seems to really have caught people's eye because he specifically says these unknowns. Again, he's not saying extraterrestrial vehicles. He's talking about anything that we can't account for that may be, again, misinterpreted by the Russians as being something of ours, which might lead to unrest or, again, suspicion that we're trying to spy on them. But what's neat is, and this is something that was pointed out to me by Stanton Friedman, as he'd been going through the National Archives and digging through some of the documentation, looking for information about Donald Menzel's alleged top-secret clearance, and it turns out that he actually had had a clearance, which, again, remarkably to me, is very seldom, if ever, talked about by more, quote-unquote, mainstream historians. I mean, Stan was absolutely right. Menzel did have the clearance. That may not be, you know, the smoking gun that proves MJ-12, but again, from studying MJ-12 and a possible hoax, which Stanton had, of course, thought it was from the outset, maybe not so much these days, but you know, in digging into that, he did find that there was a clearance held by Menzel. And this was revealed as a result of correspondences in the National Archives between Menzel and JFK, who had been, I guess, on, I think he was like on the board of directors, I think, at Yale University. And he, in order to host this position, what one had to do, they had to, you know, pick an area of interest to them. Kennedy's had been astronomy, which I found kind of interesting, considering, again, that hushed though it was in the days leading up to his own demise, Kennedy had apparently been sending out this memorandum, which did seem to reference UFOs. It really did seem to reference UFOs. Again, trying to find any information about Nixon is a little more difficult, although there are those, and Stanton Friedman, once again, is the very one who will tell you that he had spoken to many people. Researcher Grant Cameron has said the same thing just as well. Supposedly, Nixon had a personal interest in UFOs and even had a small section in his library that was all books devoted to that subject. But again, he never apparently publicly had really said a whole lot about it. Gerald Ford, of course, certainly did, and at the, I guess this was actually dating back to the time that he was a senator, but he had been asked about UFOs and had actually tried to call for hearings on that subject.
Mr. Ford, what about flying saucers? You've had some in Michigan in the past week. Do you really believe in flying saucers? You've called for a congressional investigation.
Dave, we've had several incidents in Michigan in the last week, incidents that many reliable, good citizens felt were sufficient to justify some action by our government, and not the kind of flippant answer that was given by the Air Force, where they passed it off as a swamp gas.
Swamp gas, of course, being the famous supposition made by none other than J. Allen Hynek. And he actually made a very credible case for that, but later went off to say, you know, I'd been a debunker early on, but he said the plethora of data that was forthcoming in the years that followed really made a believer, or should I say an advocate, out of me, or he, J. Allen Hynek. Jimmy Carter also expressed interest after he saw one of the damn things.
Gathered in a schoolyard with about 20 other men, and we saw a bright light appear in the distant western skies, and it got closer and closer, and when it was just above the treetops, it changed color, and then it stayed there for a while, and then it disappeared into the distance. And none of us could ever imagine what it was, and I still don't know what it was.
Although it may not have been UFOs specifically that Reagan mentioned, he often would bring up the whole Star Wars thing and about the possibility of an alien threat should it ever actually arise here on Earth.
In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
Now, I want to bring up something completely different from Reagan's own statements. And he made that statement right there numerous times. I think there were a couple of press conferences and then also speaking before the United Nations just as well. There was also a story that when E.T., the film, Spielberg's film, was shown there at the White House, there was the story that Reagan had actually made some statements about that. And further, again, the more conspiracy-laden idea, as the story was retold and retold by two friends, and then they told two friends, and they told two friends, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Anyway, what allegedly happened was that he was grabbed and hushed out of the room, you know, wasn't allowed to talk about this. Funny, nobody ever brings this part up, but Spielberg himself, Steven Spielberg, actually has gone on record and talked about what happened that night when E.T. was shown at the White House.
I was there. It was in the White House screening room.
Yeah.
And Reagan got up to thank me for bringing the film to show him, to show the president, the first lady, and all of their guests,
yeah,
which included Sandra Day O'Connor in her first week as a justice of the Supreme Court,
yeah,
and it included some astronauts. I think Neil Armstrong was there. I'm not 100% certain, but it was an amazing evening. And he just stood up and he looked around the room almost like he was doing a head count, and he said, "I want to thank you for bringing E.T. to the White House. We really enjoyed your movie." And then he looked around the room and he said, "And there are a number of people in this room who know that everything on that screen is absolutely true." And he said it without smiling. but he said that, and everybody laughed. By the way, the whole room laughed because he presented it like a joke, but he wasn't smiling as he said it.
Yeah.
The room did laugh, and then later on, I'll never forget my conversation with the president. He pulled me aside. He said, "And I can't do Reagan, but I wish I could do that breathy, wonderful voice of his."
Yeah.
And Nancy Reagan was standing right next to him, and the president said to me, "There's only one. I only have one criticism about your movie." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "How long were the end credits?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, maybe three and a half minutes. He said, "In my day, when I was an actor, our end credits were maybe 15 seconds long."
Back in my day. speaking about Steven Spielberg and the UFO encounters, this is kind of interesting. I've got one more Spielberg soundbite that I want to add here. He's not a president, but again, as it relates to his actual interactions with Ronald Reagan, who seemed to have interest in that subject, and the confirmation of the incident there when it was shown at the White House. Long suspected to be a rumor. Again, he says, "I know I was there." This is what he said and how it happened. But he has said other things about UFO encounters and even his own personal inquiries and interest, which, of course, kind of led to the close encounters the way it was presented.
After Jaws finished, I came back and I wanted to relate to dry land, and I also wanted to think about close encounters. So I went out to Pear Blossom, which is the desert near Mojave. There's nothing around for miles, and if you want to watch the cosmos, that's the place to stand and do it. I mean, you feel like a grain of salt, and the stars are so vast. I mean, it's almost like looking down at the sky because the sky surrounds you. It's an amazing planetarium show. And I went out there, and I parked my car, turned the lights out, and sat on the roof, and looked up at the sky, and said to myself, if something comes down here right now and lands on the road, and an opening appears, would I get on and take a ride? And I thought about it, and I looked up at the sky, and I got very, very nervous because I realized that I wouldn't get on and take a ride. As a matter of fact, I was getting so nervous by embracing and romancing that thought that I got back in my car and I drove back to Los Angeles. I was terrified. On Eastern Airlines from L.A. to New Orleans, and my production designer, who was on the airplane with me, was talking to the stewardesses about the movie we were making, and he mentioned to one of the stewardesses that it was a film about dealing, you know, with UFOs. And the stewardess apparently went into the cabin and mentioned this to the pilot, and all of a sudden this big, steely, gray-haired guy with wings on his chest comes out, the pilot of the airplane. They point me out. He sits down next to me, and he said, will this be a serious movie, or is this just going to be a comedy or a sci-fi? And I said, no, we were taking the subject very serious. And then knowing that I wasn't about to laugh in his face and ridicule what he was about to tell me, he sat down and he told me two experiences he had while flying with Eastern. One was a nocturnal light that traveled very, very quickly across his glide path. It startled everybody because of its speed. It wasn't a shooting star. It wasn't up there. It was eye level. And moving very, very, very quickly, something that was passing very close across his bow. I wouldn't put it past this government that a cosmic Watergate has been underway for the last, 25 years. And at the same time, I don't think it's I think as we're growing up, or from the government's point of view, I think we've, you know, we've been adults for hundreds of years, but from the government's point of view, we're still growing up, and eventually they might want to tell us something about what they've discovered over the decades. There is a rumor that was in U.S. News and World Report a number of months ago that Jimmy Carter might make make some unsettling disclosures about the UFO phenomena sometime in December. It's perfect timing. I opened my movie in December, so it's perfect timing.
Now, of course, history shows that when Jimmy Carter did go to then CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush and he tried to get information about UFOs, he was told what? Sir, Mr. President, you don't have a need to know for that information. Which brings us to George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, I find him to be extremely interesting because, again, being a former CIA man, and then he became president, I was particularly interested in seeing what role the Bush family might have played in regard to all the UFO stuff. Now, this is from researcher Grant Cameron. Back in 1988, during his campaign to become president, George Bush broke with his standard silence on the UFO issue on one occasion, which involves a gentleman who actually spoke to both the senior and his son, Governor Bush, a number of years later, as we'll see. The incident reawakened ufologists, again, who believed that for years George Bush had been one of the key members, possibly even of the alleged MJ-12 group itself, who had been involved in covering things up. Now, on March 7, 1988, during a trip to a George Bush for President rally in Rogers, Arkansas, Bush was about to go into a building to meet with reporters when a UFO researcher approached him. This guy's name was Charles Huffer. He was actually a MUFON state director. In the days back before 9/11, Huffer and his tape recorder were allowed to walk up to a vice president and ask them UFO questions. So he goes up to him and he says, "Mr. Bush, Mr. President," and he says, "will you tell the people the truth about UFOs?" He had erroneously called him president at that time. Again, he actually would have been vice president, but he was running for the office of POTUS. Now, according to the recordings that he has, he says that Bush replies, "Yeah." He says, "If we can find it, what it is, we are really interested." So Huffer says, "You'll have it? Then you'll have it? It's in there." He says it would be in his briefing when he became president. That's aside. He says, "Declassify it and tell us, okay?" Bush says, "Okay, all right, yes." It didn't sound like maybe he was all that interested, right? Bush enters the building where he'd met with the local Arkansas press. Huffer remained outside and waited for Bush when he came back out. When he did come back out, Huffer, still with his tape recorder running, runs up to George and says, "Going to hold you to that promise." Bush says, "All right." "Okay," Huffer says. "You're going to get it. I mean the UFO information." And Bush says, "You know, why don't you send me some information about it?" And Huffer says, "No, you're the CIA man. You know all that stuff." Bush says, "I know some. I know a fair amount." Oh, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall when that happened. Now, there was another incident that actually occurred with, again, George W. Bush. This one, again, from back in the year 2000. Charles Huffer, in an email correspondence with Randy Kitcher, wrote to him. He said, "Randy," he said, "please send this to all persons who may be interested. There seems to be a great deal of confusion about what really transpired." He said, "I am the unidentified citizen that was recently referenced on a CNN transcript on the Nightline program. The Washington Post article has my name as it appears on my card, which I gave to the reporter who interviewed me immediately after I'd had my first exchange with then-Governor George Bush." He said, "The websites are all still up and running as I write this," and he links to the Washington Post article. "On the CNN transcript is the following," he says, "along the way, someone thought Cheney's impressive resume would help help Bush tell the truth about UFOs." So, someone identified as an unidentified citizen, that was Huffer. He said, "Half the public believes that they are real. Would you finally tell us what is going on?" The full exchange of words with Governor Bush was evidently not recorded. He said, "I had a recorder on, but it was too far away for clarity. I did get Bush's reply, however." "Sure I will. This man knows. He was Secretary of Defense and was a great one." And he apparently points to Cheney when Cheney comes walking up at that point. Now, several minutes later, again, I saw Governor Bush in the hall. He recognized me immediately and unsolicited said approximately the follow. This is George Bush saying this to Huffer. "It'll be the first thing that he," and he points to Cheney again, "it's going to be the first thing he'll do. We'll get right on it." So Huffer asks him, "Will you really?" Talking about UFOs. "Yes, sir." He says, "I have this exchange on audio tape, and as far as I'm aware, no news organization reported it." So Bush did promise to tell us what is going on if he gets to be president. He says, please pass this around so that people will know what actually was said on the 28th of July 2000 by Governor George W. Bush in Springdale, Arkansas. Now we must help Governor Bush be elected president. Well, doesn't really seem like he had a whole lot to say, but after him, somebody else certainly did. No, I'm sorry. Let's back up, actually. Because, okay, while he was in office, Bill Clinton did at least mention that. The audio I want to come to, actually, again, comes from after his presidency. But we'll come back around to that in a moment. There was one audio clip from while he was actually in office, again, between the two Bush presidencies. And this is what Clinton had said back in the 1990s about UFOs.
I got a letter from 13-year-old Ryan from Belfast. Now, Ryan, if you're out in the crowd tonight, here's the answer to your question. No. As far as I know, an alien spacecraft did not crash in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947.
That's the gist of it, at least. So, now, of course, he came back around, again, being asked by Jimmy Kimmel on his program. We've heard this audio several times, but just to very briefly recap a bit of it.
If I was president, and I won't be, let's be honest, the first thing I would do after putting my hand on that Bible and taking that oath to serve the country is I wouldn't even probably finish the oath. I would run to the White House. I'd demand to see all the classified files on the UFOs. Because I want to know. I'd want to know what has been going on. Did you do that?
Sort of. Yeah, we had I think it was at the beginning of my second term. We had the anniversary of Roswell.
You waited that long?
I did.
Wow.
Well, I didn't. And then there's also Area 51. You remember there was a great sci-fi movie where there was an alien kept deep under the ground in Area 51? So first I had people go look at the records on Area 51 to make sure there was no alien down there. And people thought that because everybody who works there has to stop about an hour away and put on special clothing and then drive in and out. And that's because a lot of our stealth technology is made there. We know that now. But there are no aliens there.
Anyway, he goes on to talk a little bit more about that. I want to, as the final clip that we'll have time for tonight, feature our current standing commander-in-chief, Barack Obama. Now, he had been asked about this by Tim Russert during a debate in 2008, but more recently, once again, he actually, in an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel, spoke more directly about the subject.
So this is something I feel like, if I was the president, and it's unlikely that that is ever going to happen.
You never know.
If I was the president...
It was unlikely that I was going to be president.
The moment I was inaugurated, my hand would just, it'd still be hot from touching the Bible, and I would immediately race to wherever they have the files about Area 51 and the UFOs, and I'd go through everything to find out what happened.
Right.
Did you do that?
That's why you will not be president. Because that's the first thing that you would do.
The
aliens won't let it happen. You reveal all their secrets.
Now, he said other things, too. He's actually discussed Area 51. If anything, I'd say that Obama's probably said more about UFOs while actually holding the position of commander-in-chief than many before him. But it goes to show, and I hope that the fundamental takeaway from this entire discussion we've had tonight is that there has been a long interest in UFOs by our various presidents over the years, over the decades. I certainly think that depending on who is elected in the next election, there will probably continue to be an interest. And while, again, many in the scientific community will say there's nothing to see here, many still hope that if there is information, again, in the realm of politics, that the release can be pushed for. And if indeed information like that is found to substantiate some UFO claims, would it further the interest of the science community in the future? I guess, as is often the case, only time will tell, but I would argue here, in the realm of politics, there has certainly been historical precedent for UFO interest, and many of our commanders-in-chief have held that very interest themselves. That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Rayson Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, I remain the doctor in the dark heart of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. Check us out online, www.graylianreport.com, or shoot me an email, info@micahhanks.com. I bid you adieu once again, my friends. Have a great week, and until next time, Stay strange.
Listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.